powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Bump and Stacey
on Seattle Sports.
Streaming through the Seattle Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Michael Bumpus and Stacey Ross.
Here we go now.
Talk about the Mariners with Daniel Kramer of MLB.com. He joins us now on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. And Daniel, Bump and I have been talking a lot about Julio's start to the season today, so that's where we're actually going to start with you. What have you made of his at-bats? Have you seen sparks of something? Do they all look pretty bad? Is he getting unlucky, or is he just not performing?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a mix of everything. I mean, you've seen the things that he's talked about wanting to do better, which is to have that two-strike approach where, you know, he's shrinking the zone, he's not trying to do too much, and he's laying off bad pitches and hunting, you know, the ones that he knows that he can do damage with. And you saw it the other night when he had that, you know, the bases loaded breakthrough. You saw it a couple weeks ago with the walk-off against Boston. But it just seems like those moments have kind of been fewer and further between, especially as, you know, some of the strikeouts have piled up on him lately, to the point where he's expanding. He's chasing off-speed out of the zone regularly, to the point where, you know, Scott Servais wanted to give him the day off yesterday to unplug. Obviously, that changed a little bit given the stakes of the game and where they were at there in the ninth inning. But, you know, it's just tough for him because he's talked so much about wanting to make these adjustments, and then you see him kind of revert back to the things that got him in trouble last year. And though he did, you know, have a great season, he finished fourth in the MVP, yada, yada, but he talked this spring about, you know, really wanting to be more consistent with his approach over the course of six full months rather than maybe like a hot 6 week stretch that we saw last summer. So, you know, it's 3 weeks into the season, and I think, you know, the team-wide performance, you know, has kind of probably fallen on his shoulders too. He does want to perform for the team. He does want to, you know, thrive in those big moments, but, you're just starting to see, you know, him get back into some of the things that got him in trouble last year.
We're trying to find silver linings today when it comes to this Mariners team. And, you know, you can look at stats, you look at the data to support your argument, whether it be positive or negative. Is there a stat or some data point that you look at that says, you know, eventually this team's going to turn it around? We know who these guys are on the back of their baseball card, right? And I think that's kind of what we've leaned on. Is that something you would lean on, or is there something else that you see to say, all right, I can see this team turning a corner? Or do you think they are who they are and it's going to be a struggle all year?
I think the starting pitching kind of turning things around this past time through, that was an encouraging sign. I guess they haven't gotten all the way through the rotation yet. You know, we got George Kirby tonight and, you know, Logan Gilbert tomorrow. But just they've, you know, until Saturday night, when they threw a quality start, they were undefeated in each of those five games. You know, that changed with the ensuing two, with Emerson Hancock, you know, two runs over six innings and a tough loss on Saturday night where the offense didn't get much going. And then you started to see Luis Castillo turn things around a little bit more yesterday. Still some troubles and two strike counts, you know, with a double to Dansby Swanson when he was ahead 0-2. And then, you know, the homer to Michael Busch, who kind of just tormented them all weekend. That was in a 2-2 count. So you want to see him get a little bit better with those put-away pitches, but he still had nine punchies, six innings, three earned. You know, he kind of did his part, just needed a little bit more run support. So some encouraging signs with him in that regard, but kind of tying into the greater theme of the rotation. Like, if they can pitch, and I was never really worried about some of the hiccups they had the second time through, because, you know, the talent is there and the stuff is there. And you got these guys eat innings too, especially, which is huge. But if they can kind of like get that back on track, I figured that they would be in good shape. And you're starting to see that a little bit more. But, you know, now it comes back to the run support component because, you know, if their starter goes out, gives them six innings, three runs or fewer, they're probably going to be in good shape, but they need the lineup to hold up their end of the bargain too.
Speaking of that starting lineup and looking at some of the offense, what do you think is behind Now, again, Daniel, I recognize there are many answers to this, so feel free to just say whatever comes to mind for you. What's behind an offense when the entirety of a lineup really struggles or when lots of players are struggling? Because it's not just Julio with a slow start. You know, we're seeing the offense as a whole really struggle. And then I think, understandably, you get questions from fans about, like, you know, is it their approach? Is it a philosophy? Is it whatever? What do you think is behind the offense as a whole really struggling?
Yeah, I think you can go a lot of ways with that one. But one line post game yesterday from Scott Servais really stood out to me. And, you know, he doesn't really say this very often, but it, from his vantage point, it looked like they were trying too hard in some of those moments, which kind of ties back into the greater theme of our guys pressing, our guys forcing the issue. And that can kind of get you into trouble, especially when you have those situational moments where the end of the pressure should be going back onto the pitcher rather than on the hitter, especially when you have them on the ropes there like they did in both the seventh and the eighth inning yesterday. I mean, the game was there for the taking. So, you know, publicly, a lot of the guys don't really think that that's the issue, but some, you know, conversations behind the scenes might suggest otherwise, that they recognize that they're off to a slow start by the standards that they had hoped to. And that they also recognize the urgency which with they spoke with in spring training about wanting to get off to that fast start after missing the playoffs by a game last year. So, I think that you've started to see, a little bit more of a forceful approach in some of those at-bats, you know, particularly over the weekend. And Scott's comments after the game, I don't know, kind of stood out to me in that regard. Mm.
We're going to see Jonathan Klase here pretty soon. How do you view this move? Obviously, it's something needed to be done with Canzon going down. We're probably going to see a bit more Dylan Moore. Do you feel like this is a reach? Or me, I saw it as just accelerating the process due to the circumstances. How do you view this, and what are your expectations of this young man?
Yeah, I thought kind of the same, too. But, you know, reflecting on it a little bit more, it's probably just the situation that they're in. He had a really good spring. They loved what he did last year. They wanted to see a little bit more in terms of offensive development. So I guess like the timing of how soon into the regular season that he's up is maybe a little bit of a surprise. But, you know, like you said, tying back into the roster need that they have right now with Dom going down, I guess that's what they saw. Klase would be the best fit for that. You know, you did have some other options you could have gone with. We saw Samad Taylor come up and make a good impression when Ty hit the paternity list last week in Milwaukee. Caden Marlowe is another guy, too, who came up and, you know, had a productive stretch there late in the season when Jared kicked the Gatorade cooler last year. There were some options, so I guess it was a little bit curious to see why they went with Klase, and, you know, eager to get a little bit more insight onto that when we get to the clubhouse here in a couple hours. But as far as, you know, the tools, he's arguably the fastest player in the system, other than Julio, but, you know, he's right up there with them. A pretty historic minor league season last year with the power-speed combo. He had 20 homers, 79 stolen bases, and, you know, since minor league statistics began tracking back in 1961, nobody else has ever done that before. So, and then, like I said, a strong spring training where, you know, he gets on the base paths and he's just got no fear out there. He will go because he's just got the confidence and the wheels to do it. And so he caught Scott Servais' attention a lot, and he's the kind of guy that, you know, Scott would – like to have off of his bench too, especially late in games to make things happen if the situation calls for it. So curious to see what he can bring. And, you know, we've been hearing about this guy for a couple of years now. So eager to see what he can do at the major league level.
Kind of getting back to Julio, I know we started the conversation by asking about what you've seen from his start. What about just what you see from Julio as a player? I think that we can get so micro-focused on struggles that we forget about someone's potential and everything they've done. Can you kind of remind us of what Julio can mean to the team?
Yeah. I mean, I know that there's like a strong supporting cast around him, even though it doesn't necessarily look like that right now with the way they're hitting. But this team and this offense in so many ways goes as he goes. If you saw what they did last August, setting a franchise record with 21 victories, it was no coincidence that Julio Rodriguez was the hottest player on the planet. I mean, you can see him single-handedly lift them to victory on any given night if he's just playing at that level. Now, it's hard to sustain that MVP-type level that he was last summer, night in and night out, but just the more consistency, if he's able to do that, there is a lot of upside to what the rest of this lineup can do. So eager to talk to him, hopefully, about some of his struggles. He kind of wanted to not do that yesterday, given the way the game ended, and, you know, he was, you know, off for the day, too, on top of that. So curious to hear, like, what his thoughts are about, like, where things stand with him right now. But I'm not worried about him long term, if that's kind of what folks are getting at. I think that there's a really good player there, and it's just getting to be more consistent with it, I think, is the biggest key with him.
We hate seeing the team struggle the way that they have been, but when you look across the division, you got the Rangers 8-8, Angels 7-8, and then obviously you got the A's in front of you at 7-9, and you got Seattle and the Astros at the bottom of the division. Somehow, some way, they're only two games back. But how much longer do you think they have? Because we know that we feel the Houston Astros are going to turn things around. The Rangers are on top. What's the sense of urgency when it comes to just getting back in this and not just hanging around and taking advantage of this opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, like, as far as the standings go, I don't really look at them for like at least 4, 6, sometimes 8 weeks into the season. I think Memorial Day is a really good barometer to when you really start to look at that. But like you said, it is a division that houses the past two World Series champions. And, you know, like we talked about earlier, how they were right there at the end last season, just the urgency of wanting to kind of like seize the opportunity while, you know, some of these teams are banged up. You know, Texas is without Josh Young. The Astros have been without Verlander, some other injuries there too. So it, you know, even if like collectively the AL West takes a little bit of a step back, I still see it being a fairly competitive division throughout the season. And so, yeah, it would behoove them to take advantage of, you know, some other teams' lulls, and especially, you know, why they're at full strength. I say all that, but, you know, Canzone's hitting the IL today. So, getting going and, you know, kind of building some momentum to carry into the early leg of the summer, because, you know, Texas and Houston, I don't really think they're going anywhere.
Now, on the outside looking in, it's easy to be frustrated with bad baseball. With the start of the season, it's not fun to watch, even though everyone knows it's early. I'm always curious as to how players feel, because, look, they have more at stake than anyone. It's their careers. They're the ones showing up doing it, but they also have more faith in themselves and in their team than I would imagine anyone else. What's the vibe like in the clubhouse from players that you've spoken with about the start to the season?
Yeah, it is a curious concept. I think it's so easy to kind of get lost up in a lot of the noise that, you know, is happening outside of the clubhouse. So I'm, you know, constantly curious about what they're thinking about inside. And talking just with JP Crawford yesterday, Mitch Garver, Jorge Polanco, Dylan Moore, like all of them kind of before the game, there's no like sense of panic. And I don't think there necessarily should be, because if you do that, especially at this stage of the season, you know, you could get yourself into some trouble, like Scott was saying, trying too hard. You know, these guys recognize that these games count and these games matter, and they're frustrated when they're not getting the results. But I don't think that they're, you know, sitting there feeling bad for themselves or that the sky is falling. You know, they're big league professional ball players. They know what they need to do. And, you know, I haven't taken away any sense of like panic from speaking to those guys as recently as yesterday morning.
We mentioned we're going to see Kalasa here pretty soon. Is there anyone else in the minors that you feel like has the potential to be called up this year?
Yeah, I mean, they got a few guys. The two that I think are getting closer and will kind of hinge on, you know, how their player development goes at Tacoma is Tyler Locklear and Ryan Bliss, two infielders coming off, you know, really, really strong finishes to last year, and both played in the Arizona Fall League, both had good spring training. I think with them in particular, it'll probably be based on positional need, much like you just saw with Clase coming up and taking the outfield spot that Dom left. So, you know, kind of curious to see how those guys develop. And then, you know, one guy who I don't think or I know won't be in the big leagues this year, but who everybody behind the scenes is talking about taking a huge leap forward is a pitcher named Logan Evans, who skipped high A Everett and started on opening day at double A. And he was a 12th round draft pick last July. And so just to see, you know, the rapid rate that he's kind of gotten off to his pro start, it's a 5 and 6 pitch mix. You know, he's added a ton of velocity, a new sweeper to, you know, some more depth on his curveball and things like that. Just curious to see what he does this year, given just how excited a lot of people within the organization are, and, you know, their well-chronicled track record of developing starting pitchers.
Make sure you're reading more from Daniel Kramer at MLB.com. Thanks so much, Daniel. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Daniel.
All right, guys. Thank you.
See ya. Let's get to Headline Rewrites.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Headline Rewrites.
We must make headlines.
The real story behind the headlines in today's news with Bump and Stacey.
Headline number one, the Seahawks finally added some depth to their offensive line, bringing veteran offensive lineman Laken Tomlinson to a one-year deal. What's the real headline?
Let's see if this patchwork boat can float.
It better float. It needs to float. You got too much talent offensively for it not to. Tomlinson signs a one-year deal up to $4 million, got $100,000 guaranteed. He was a first-round draft pick in 2015, five seasons with the San Francisco 49ers, 2021 Pro Bowler. In the Jets, he did have two bad years, according to PFF. Also gave up 7 sacks in 2023. A one-year deal is perfect. See if you come in, mentor these guys. Can you tap into some greatness that you displayed over your years in the NFL? Mm-hmm. And we shall see. One-year deals is the way to go. They are not going to invest heavily in some of these veterans, but the Seahawks realize that you need these guys around. Damian Lewis is with the Carolina Panthers now. You got to fill a void. I believe Phil Haynes is still a free agent out there floating around. So I think that they're securing the offensive line. I still expect them to address it in the draft as other many positions. But, yeah, no, I like it. I like it, man. See if he can tap into something special again. If not, address that position in the draft and let's get going.
It's going to be really interesting watching how John Schneider mixes this group together. On the outside, either tackle spot, you've got two young franchise guys. Yes, you want to see more from them and continued growth and development, but you have your long-term answers there, assuming they stay healthy, with Charles Cross at left tackle and Abe Lucas at right. Behind them, you even have some experienced depth. George Fant has been a starter, and he's backing up Abe Lucas just in case that knee becomes an issue. The interior of the line, as you know, as fans know, is really a question mark. I mean, you have a brand new center there. Is it going to be your second-year player, Olu Oluwatimi, who did not win the job from Evan Brown last year? Is it going to be Nick Harris, who has limited experience? You have guys that are either a little bit older, like 32-year-old Laken Tomlinson, or guys with exceptionally limited experience. Maybe they only have 3 starts under their belt. Maybe they have 6. Maybe they've primarily been a backup. But the interior of that line is going to have a lot of questions. And it's why everyone's eyes are on Troy Fautanu, particularly if they swap him to guard.
Go get him. I'm looking at the depth chart. Laken, left guard, all by himself. All by himself.
Oh, no. I forgot we were doing this.
It's the last day we can do this until next year. Headline number 2, Scotty Scheffler is the 2024 Masters champion after he cruised to a 4-stroke victory yesterday. What's the real headline?
Welcome back, Bump. We're happy to have you.
I'm here.
It's like Aaron Rodgers coming out of his darkness retreat. You came back from your Masters retreat.
I did. I did everything I could to watch this game and still be a present father and husband.
And how'd that go?
It went actually pretty good. You know, you watch a lot of it on your phone, on iPad, at the restaurant when you're sitting down eating, your wife is talking to you, and I position her right in front of a TV. So it looks like I'm looking at you, but I'm really watching the Masters. Big ups to Scotty Scheffler, man. 3 wins in 2024, 8 top 10 finishes. He's first in the FedEx standing. I mean, my guy is first when it comes to green and regulation. He's 6th when it comes to proximity. He's getting on the green when he's supposed to, and he's putting the ball close. He's got 34 consecutive cuts. He's the best player on the planet right now, and he's nowhere near close to what Tiger did in his prime.
Let's talk about it. Scotty became the 4th youngest player to win 2 Masters titles. Woods also did so by 25 years old, which is absolutely insane. Dan Patrick earlier this morning was talking about Scottie Scheffler and all the comparisons people were making to Tiger and saying, look, what he's did is really, really great, but pump the brakes. You're siding with Dan saying, look, you can say he's one of the more impressive golfers, we've seen since Tiger, but that does not mean he's touching his greatness.
Yeah, most impressive since Tiger doesn't mean that he's in the same category as Tiger. Tiger, PGA Tour Player of the Year. You ready for this? 97, 99, 2000, 01, 02, 03, 05, 06, 07, 09, and 13. All right, another step. PGA Tour Moneyless Winner, 97, 99, 2000, 01, 02, 05, 06, 07, 09, 13 of them. Thanks. I'm just saying, he's on his way. He is on his way. But he ain't on his way to Tiger. He's on his way just to being one of the greats.
I like the way you compared it this morning, saying this is not a LeBron MJ conversation. No. Mac, for the love of God, can we move to the next headline?
Headline rewrites.
Headline number 3, as we talked about with Daniel Kramer a few moments ago, the Mariners calling up 21-year-old outfielder Jonathan Clase to replace the injured Dom Canzone. What's the real headline?
A 21-year-old isn't saving your offense. I don't think I'm shocking anyone by saying this. I'm not ripping off the Band-Aid here. There is plenty to be excited about. He's exceptionally speedy, the Mariners' number 10 prospect, according to MLB Pipeline. Canzone heading to the IL, so you could use the help, especially with Sam Haggerty hurt. But this is not someone that's coming here to save anyone or anything the way that we hoped Julio and prior to that Kelnick might.
He's got 39 ABs in AAA. Just 39. He has 1,400 overall, but just 39 in AAA. Does have an OPS of over 1,000. He's doing what he's supposed to do at that level if you are considered one of the top prospects. He has been described as an aggressive, energetic player who excites and frustrates. So, I mean, we've already been frustrated. Bring some excitement. Do what you do. Low expectations for this young man, though. Again, he's 21 years old. He's not going to come in and save the day. If he puts together a few at-bats and gets a couple hits and maybe drive in a couple runs, good for him. But sustainability is not something that I'm thinking about, because we know that Canzone is going to be back eventually. This is a trial period. This is that peacock trial period, and then they hope that you forget about it. We're not going to forget about Canzone. It's a trial period, and then we'll cancel the subscription and get Canzone back in there. But it's going to be fun to watch all the shows you want to for as long as Canzone is gone.
Can I get on my soapbox for just the last minute of this segment and say the same thing that I texted you guys on Friday, which is there are some people who might find $9.99 prohibitively expensive, and I don't begrudge you for that. It's not my money, it's your money. However, I saw people complaining so much about Apple TV and just kept thinking, like, it's $10. It's a streaming service. They're gonna have more games. They're gonna have TV shows. Like, you can do a free trial if you wanna cancel it. Come up with another email for the next game that's gonna be on there. I really don't think it's this, like, horrible burden that people make it out to be. And I would just like to gently push back against that, respectfully decline that kind of argument. I just, no offense, if you're someone that really struggled with it, then you're not part of this conversation. I'm talking about people that can absolutely afford it, that just want to pretend like, I refuse to pony up for this. Pony up $10? I think you should be banned from using the word pony up when it's like less than $50.
People don't like change, man. They don't like change. We already got to stream and use Fubo to get Roots Sport and all that. Hey, it is what it is. You have no control over the situation. If you want to watch more baseball or you want to watch your Mariners when they are on Apple TV, you know what you got to do. If not, just shh. And
that's what I'm saying.
Listen to the game on 710. We got you.
Exactly. You can listen for free right here on Seattle Sports, and that's great. But, like, if you don't want to pay, then don't pay. But I don't buy that as many people that complain about the price actually find that price prohibitive. It's just that it's annoying. It's something they don't want to do. I'm just saying, I've been watching Palm Royale. It's a wonderful show starring Kristen Wiig. It's on Apple TV.
Isn't really Yellowstone on Peacock?
Paramount, I think.
Paramount?
Either way, these streaming services, you know what the thing is, too? I got rid of cable forever ago, so I use only streaming services. So for me, I'm like,
Apple TV's Ted Lasso.
Yeah, like,
The new, or not the newsroom. What's that one with Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon?
Yeah.
Morning show. Yeah.
Nelson and Kent, it's $10, sure, but when you pay $280 for Comcast and then you already pay for Netflix, Hulu, Paramount Plus, blah, 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 all these other platforms. All right, but that's the thing. You're already paying so much for all these other platforms. Clearly, you value paying money for your entertainment. Like, you're already paying for it. Again, then listen to the broadcast for free on here. I saw a lot of this idea of, like, Apple TV just, like, wringing out our wallets. And I was like, man, I don't know that I'd consider $9.99 to be
Everyone ain't rich like you, though.
Yeah, I am rich.
Everyone don't make the money you make.
I am incredibly wealthy. Yeah, I don't know. I just, Apple TV I also see as like a basic subscription thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like I had Apple TV before I had Peacock or Paramount.
Yeah, I got Apple TV just for baseball, honestly. That's it.
I got Peacock not even for the game, but for the uncensored version of the Vanderpump Rules reunion.
Uncensored? They have uncensored version? Mm-hmm.
Wow. With the cussing?
It's even
with
better.
With the cussing?
Yeah. It's crazy. I don't know. You can disagree with me if you want, and that's fine. I just didn't buy this idea of ponying up for $9. Coming up, two star receivers haven't shown up to voluntary workouts, and another pushes back against trade rumors. Don't go anywhere.
Bumpin' Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On Seattle Sports.
Here are your hosts, Michael Bumpus and Stacy Ross.
The Jets are looking a little fresher in 2024. They revealed new uniforms today. They're making their white throwback jerseys the official road set and then added green and black versions for home and alternate. I have never been a huge fan of the Jets color scheme as a whole, but I like these jerseys. What did you think?
Good, because you don't like the Boston Celtics. We hate the Boston Celtics.
Yeah.
And that's green. No, I like them, though. Like I said, I like the simple, strong lines, strong colors. I'm with that. I think it looks good. I think, you know, it's going to make it look real good. Sauce going to put some sauce on that uniform.
I was going to say winning.
It's going to look clean. Yeah. That'll make it look more better. But as far as just running out the tunnel, Sauce is going to make that thing look good.
According to Adam Schefter of ESPN, the Detroit Lions are also going to debut new jerseys later this week. TBD what they're going to look like.
Don't mess with it, Detroit.
Well, I didn't get the impression it was like some special throwback that it was going to be like a revamped, unless I misread what he said.
I think it's going to be, I don't know if it's going to be a full-on throwback, but I imagine it's going to look a little closer to what like the Barry Sanders era looked like.
Well,
those are clean jerseys.
Yeah. This made me feel kind of old. Some more uniform news. The Jags are bringing back their uniforms worn during the 90s and early 2000s as their throwbacks for the 2024 season. I clicked on this and looked at the jersey and said, I remember this jersey. It's one thing when it's the Seahawks throwbacks.
Fred Taylor, Mark Brunell jersey.
I wasn't around for the Seahawks throwbacks. I've only ever seen them in photos and I've always thought they looked like, they look older. They look of an era.
They don't. I think those look modern.
That's what I'm saying.
They should have never gone away from them.
No, when I look at the Seahawks ones, I see like this is of a time. Uh-huh. Like this is retro is when I see the Seahawks, like the style of it is retro. Mm-hmm. The Jags just looks like something that you kind of remember from when you were younger. It looks like something that could be a jersey today. It would be not super nice looking, but it's not. Nothing about it says throwback to me.
Nah, this is right up my alley too. Not a lot going on.
Yeah.
Put some little stripes on the sleeves. Everything else is solid. This is and it's nice to have Fred Taylor, old man Fred Taylor, over there, man.
They're a lot of fun.
Yeah, they were.
To be fair, when you're a newer franchise, you're limited in how much of a throwback you can really have, and I get that, but I don't know. I don't know about this one. We're on from the uniform conversation, moving to the wide receiver conversation. Both CeeDee Lamb and Justin Jefferson have been absent from the Cowboys and Vikings offseason programs as they await contract extensions.
Of course they're not there. They want to secure their future, their bag, before they show up. I have no problem with this. It's not like they are the Seattle Seahawks with so many coaching changes, a new offense, new defense, new position coach. No, they running it back, essentially, with the Cowboys and the Vikings, and these are their best players. You take care of your body. Take care of yourself. The worst thing that could happen, you show up for these voluntary workouts, you get hurt. Now they have even more leverage when it comes to negotiating your contract or extension. I'm good. They'll be fine. Trust me. They're going to go for 1,000 yards, have 100 catches, and 8 touchdowns.
I think we're already pretty confident that the Cowboys are certainly going to extend CeeDee Lamb, not only because they need him, but that's kind of the reason they didn't do much with Dak, right? Like, the entire time that Jerry Jones was asked about offseason moves or lack thereof and what they were doing with Dak Prescott, he just kept making it clear that they have other stars to sign, hinting strongly at, like, we care about Micah Parsons and CeeDee Lamb. Like, we've got a lot of guys here we need to worry about. So neither of these guys are going anywhere. It's a matter of how much will they actually end up getting.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of, something tells me they're going to break this. The Eagles and Devonta Smith agreed to a 4-year, $90.5 million extension. It keeps him signed through the 2028 season. He had a 5th-year option picked up and then 3 years and $75 million added to it. He becomes the 5th wide receiver in the NFL to have a contract exceeding $25 million or more per year. That number is about to change.
Yeah, good for Smith, and well-deserved. Last year, 81 receptions, over 1,000 yards, and 7 touchdowns. You want to keep A.J. Brown and Smith together as long as you can or as long as they look productive. You combine him with Saquon Barkley. Right, Philly, right? Philly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Saquon Barkley in the backfield, Jalen Hurts. They're set up for success the next 2 to 3 years. So keep it together. And again, a lot of this money, they say, oh, we're going to extend him and give him money there. Once you get to that point where you have to renegotiate or you have to make a move, you put more money on the back. And there are ways to maneuver this contract. When it's all said and done, his contract won't look the way it does now when it's all, you know, when he's, what, towards the end of this deal.
I got a couple wide receiver stories. We're going to go to another wide receiver who's denying trade rumors via his agent. John Frisella, who knows, you know, how much he's got going on. 15,000 followers, NFL insider. I don't know. I don't follow his work.
Oh, sorry. Not all of us can have 20,000+ followers on Twitter, you know.
First of all,
you know, just my measly 8,800.
I have 30,000.
My bad.
Check your sources.
My bad.
He said that Brandon Ayuk has officially requested a trade from the 49ers per confirmation from my San Francisco source. And then that was retweeted by Brandon Ayuk's agent, who said, you need better sources.
Okay. Man, who knows what's truth here? Who knows what is the truth? What should be true is that the Niners are going to do everything they can to keep Brandon Ayuk. You do not want to let him go. Everyone points to Deebo Samuel, baller. George Kittle, baller. The best receiver on that team is Brandon Ayuk. The best route runner, the best hands. Deebo's just a different beast. I think you need all those guys together to make this thing go. I talked about the window closing on the Niners. If they don't sign Brandon Ayuk and let him go, the window ain't shut. It ain't nowhere near being shut, but it's closed just a bit more.
How many wide receivers would you put above Brandon Ayuk? Because in terms of total yards in 2023, he was 7th. Would you have him above Tyreek Hill, CeeDee Lamb, Amon-Ra St. Brown, Puka Nacua, who I know was just a rookie but did have more yards, A.J. Brown, and then you got Brandon Ayuk. Oh, D.J. Moore was right ahead of him, just barely, by like 20 yards.
These are guys I won't put him in front of. I still think, Diggs is a better receiver. I think Tyreek Hill's a better receiver.
Ja'Marr Chase.
A.J. Brown's a better receiver. Ja'Marr Chase.
Mike Evans?
Mike's towards the end of his deal.
Yeah,
maybe 4 or 5. Maybe 4 or 5 receivers.
Do you think he's a better receiver than DK Metcalf?
The art of route running, yes.
But as far as who you'd want?
The big playability, you take either one. You just need either a guy like DK or a guy like Brandon Ayuk on your team. And DK's in a different offense. Who knows what he looks like in a Niners offense? If I had to pick between the two, they're the same age and the same draft, I'd probably still go DK because he's more physically just imposing on the defense. So, yeah.
It's just interesting. He's in an interesting spot where it's like CeeDee Lamb is clearly one of their best offensive weapons. Obviously, Justin Jefferson is their best offensive weapon, even though he didn't have more yards. Brandon Ayuk's in this weird spot of there's so much talent around him that he doesn't get maybe as much credit as he deserves. You've talked about this a ton, how he's a much better receiver than people give him credit for. He's their best receiver, but everyone kind of looks at the team as a whole. And it really only matters what the front office does. I guess we'll find out eventually. We're going to get back to a conversation about one important position in football, an important position for the Seahawks that is ever evolving. So what's next?
Bumpin' Stacy,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on Seattle Sports.
Here are your hosts, Michael Bumpus and Stacy Rost.
We talked about this evolving tight end position as part of our conversation about Brock Bowers as a target for the Seahawks at 16. Now, Brock is widely expected to be taken by the Jets at pick number 10 or even before then, maybe not long after, should he slide past number 10 in the draft. So the Seahawks are very unlikely to have him. But we did talk about the possibility that he could be there, and Bump saying, look, if you don't have Troy Fautanu, jump all over Brock Bowers. He's a really special player. We also noticed a stat from Shio Kapadia that the over the last 10 years, all nine tight ends that have been picked in the first round have combined for zero all-pro nods and one 1,000-yard season. That's kind of where I wanted to move the conversation here because, Bump, you pointed to the way that the tight end position has evolved, saying, I don't expect that to be the case with Brock. Why?
Nah, man. Brock is, he resembles the modern tight end. And when you think of the modern tight end, you think of George Kittle. You think of Travis Kelce. I mean, those are the two that kind of raise the bar when it comes to expectations for a tight end. Last year in 2023, George Kittle had 1,000 yards. Kittle had 984. Evan Ingram had 963. Hawkinson had 960. And LaPorta had 889. That's production from that tight end position. Mm-hmm. The reason why we're starting to get production from the tight ends is because of the game. It's changing. And tight ends are changing with the game. They're training differently. A tight end back in the day had to catch a few footballs, and you have the greats of Jason Witten's, of Tony Gonzalez, Antonio Gates. I think Antonio Gates resembles more this type of tight end than those other two. I mean, Gonzalez can run a little bit, but he was just a big, massive human being. These guys are more agile and can move. They go up and get the football. They got some yak. So we looked at the stats and say, for the last 10 years, there's only one high draft pick to have over 1,000 yards. I go, yeah, you can't ignore those numbers, but the offenses we run today are different than offenses we ran in 2014 as a whole. There are always some teams that are ahead of the curve that spread guys out and get the tight end the football in different positions or whatnot. But, you know, for the most part, now we're starting to see it. I'm seeing a guy that most people don't even know, Trey McBride out of Colorado State with the Arizona Cardinals, who had 825 last year. Mm-hmm. A Dalton Kincaid out of Utah, who I think is going to keep improving. He has 673 last year. Kyle Pitts, who's supposed to be a tight end, more of a receiver to me. Just look at the body types of these tight ends and watch them run with the football. The game is changing. And Brock has the opportunity to validate that change. If he were to get drafted high, which I think he's going to, maybe if it's 16 or before, or maybe even after that, and he goes out and he plays well, what do teams do? They copy. They go, oh, okay, this next tight end group, that guy reminds me of Brock Bowers. You know what? Let's go ahead and get them. Because Brock reminds everyone of George Kittle, and we see the success that George Kittle was getting. It's everyone's a little timid to kind of jump in this tight end movement. Me, I've been all about it the past couple of years. I think that they're going to be one of the premier positions on offense, if they're not already in some organizations. Mm-hmm. People are a bit hesitant, and they're hesitant because of the numbers, and the numbers are real. But just watch the game. Just like we see receivers come into the NFL more ready to go now because of their training, the same thing is going to happen at the tight end position. The quarterback position has changed over the past 10 years as well. So change is good, and I think that's what we're seeing out of the tight ends.
Mina Kimes agrees with you. On the Mina Kimes show, her own podcast, she says that despite tight end value being what it is, she does have confidence in Bowers.
When you're suddenly, let's say you're at 15, let's hear the Colts, and you're comparing Bowers to Thomas Jr., I have a higher degree of confidence that Brock Bowers will be an NFL star right now. So for me, that's where suddenly the value starts to shift a little because of my confidence in the player.
Not said here is, look, if we're talking about Kyle Pitts and what he meant to Atlanta, well, he was a number four overall pick. If you're staring at number four in this draft, you know who's going to be available? Marvin Harrison Jr., mm-hmm. assuming 1, 2, 3 are quarterbacks. There's a different value you're looking at there. When you get to the middle of the first round, well, wait a minute. Now we're talking about the value that is worth it with a tight end, especially one as dynamic as Bowers.
Yeah, it's the player. We can look at the position and say, this is why you don't do this with this position. This is why you don't draft this position early. You should wait till later. All right, but now let's look at the player himself. Brock is not like your average tight end. Even though there has been a change in how these guys move and how they perform, there's always someone who kind of breaks the mold even a bit more and does some things that these other guys can't. That's exactly who that is. So if we just went by the position, no, I don't draft Brock. Nope, just wait. You can get a guy in the second or third round, and you'll be good to go. But if we look at the player, the things that he is doing, the way he was used over there in Georgia, used at the H-back spot, used in some reverses in the red zone, split outside and put in the slot for a mismatch. And then you look at the player and you go, he is a first-round grade when it comes to his ability despite the position. That's the tough part because there are some running backs who are probably first-round grades, but they're not going to get the nod because people understand they're going to get a 300 carries in a season, and they're going to decline rapidly. And teams are okay with that, and I'm okay with that. But the tight end is a bit different. He's not going to get 300 touches in a game, mm-hmm. but he can help in the run, help in the pass, and be dynamic. And I think that's what guys are looking for, dynamic football players, and the tight ends are becoming that.
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating to talk about kind of like where that value comes from. And I think you're right. I mean, you can find talent later. You mentioned Bowers being compared to Kittle, who ironically was a day three pick. And, you know, here's a guy who is expected to go top 10. But you're right. It's about where you land. It's about the place that you go. And honestly, you could say that for any position. Mm-hmm. Like, you can stretch the value of an elite edge rusher across multiple places, regardless of who the quarterback is. Like, that guy's going to get sacks. That guy's going to perform. But you are always dependent on the context of the place you go to, no matter what. Is that guy on a defense with other guys that can take pressure off of him, that can get some double teams? Is he getting double teams and freeing up someone else where the defense suddenly becomes lethal? You look at where some of these tight ends have gone. Like, they've gone to places without elite quarterbacks. So, I don't know. I'm totally with you. You've completely convinced me that Bowers could be bucking this trend and be a guy to come out and be who people kind of thought Kyle Pitts would.
Yeah, I mean, you pointed out you got to be connected to a good quarterback, good situation, and some talent. George Kittle, Travis Kelce, Evan Engram, TJ Hawkinson, Sam Laporta are the top five when it comes to yards in this league. Sam Laporta got Amon-Ra St. Brown. Hawkinson has Justin Jefferson. Evan Engram had Christian Kirk over there. Travis Kelce, we all know. George Kittle, we all know. So, yeah, you need help. They're not a guy who transcends an offense. That's all about the quarterback and offensive line. But he could be the guy to take you to a different place.
Mm-hmm. All right, we are going to stick with football. Dave Wyman joining us in studio next. Don't go anywhere.